The furnaces are at full heat, the moulds have been set, and the digital resin is ready to go. Let's cast another pod. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Future Library. Almost forgot the podcast name there. This is another episode. I've actually recorded two today, so I'm a little bit confused. But for the listeners, that makes no difference. My guests today, I'm astounded and amazed that both of them have agreed to come on. They are two people that I have immense respect for in their respective fields. One of them would have caused the 17-year-old me to do a little bit of a sex wee. he is the man that shaped my teenage years musically, and I will save an embarrassing story about how much so for later on during the show. He is Mr. Miles Hunt of the Wonder Stuff. Miles, how are you doing?
I'm very good, and it's a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you. The other guest we have, he's a man who makes the adult me do a little bit of a sex wee.
Oh, I'm glad. I thought you were going to say that you've become more continent as years have gone on, but I'm glad to see that I still make you piss yourself.
Yes, this is my guest. He's been synthesizer Patel on Look Around You. He's been heavily involved in Still Game. But the role for me that defines my next guest is that of Ramesh in Fags, Mags and Bags, Sanjeev Kohli.
Hello.
How are you,
Alex? I'm fine. How are you?
I'm very good.
So,
this gathering of two cross-generational geniuses or genii, whichever word I would use, I thought when I saw that, you know, there was an option for this to happen, I thought, you're not going to hear this anywhere else.
True. I do follow you, Miles. I don't know if you follow me back, and obviously there's no excuse now, you have to.
Well, if I do, so I shall amend it immediately.
Years and years and years and years ago, my brother interviewed you when he started out in radio, I think you must have played at the Barrowlands in Glasgow or something, and I think that you don't remember, but he will actually, you might. You'll be the only guy in a turban probably that did a post gig interview with you, unless there's some other turban seat doing the rounds. But I reckon if you can think back to probably, I don't know, maybe 89, 90, 91, and you remember a guy with a lilac turban, that was my brother.
Okay.
So there you go. And also, can I state, put it on the record as well that obviously Motown and Phil Spector and all that stuff are given by, for me, the two perfect pop singles are Close to Me by The Cure and
Beautiful
A Wish
song.
Away by The Wonder Stuff.
Oh.
So there you go. Perfect pop song.
Thank you very much.
You're more than welcome.
Well, I have to say, my first ever gig that I ever went to see was The Wonder Stuff playing the God Bless the Fucking Lot of Us tour or something?
Sounds like something stupid that we do, yeah.
I think it was just before you released Never Loved Elvis. And you had Ned's Atomic Dustbin and Spirit of the West supporting.
Fabulous band, Spirit of the West, Canadian band, yeah, amazing.
Yeah, and it was a fantastic show. It was the first gig I'd ever been to. It was at Aston Villa Leisure Centre. And I didn't know what to expect, and it was just, you guys came out, you opened with, I think it was Mission Drive you played, and I was like, oh, this is the good shit.
No, oh, I feel like I'm just being bathed in compliments on my gentle Wednesday afternoon.
No, Miles, my wife thinks you're shit.
Well, that's good, that's a bit of balance there.
No, genuinely, that was said to me once. I used to present this god-awful Asian magazine show called Network East, which sounds like a railway franchise. It wasn't. It was an Asian magazine show. And a guy cornered me, and he said, oh, I think you're... In fact, it was in Birmingham at the NEC. There was this thing called the Mega Mela, which was a big Asian kind of collection of stalls, basically. Uh-huh. And this guy cornered me, and he said, I think you're really funny, but my wife thinks you're shit. And do you know what? That actually improved his compliment, because I knew that he wasn't bullshitting me. That was the truth, because he told me the other truth, which is that his wife despised me. And that actually, in many ways, improved his compliment. So for me to say that my wife thinks you're shit means that actually I'm squaring the compliment. It's exponential now.
Sounds very Alan Partridge.
My wife thinks you're shit.
Well, I can safely say that my wife, as an American, doesn't have an opinion either way.
Oh. That's still like the Americans.
Why doesn't she have an opinion?
Because she's not. I've not actually kind of exposed her to enough Wonder Stuff stuff.
Okay. So it's your fault.
It is my fault. It's okay, I take the blame, Miles. There's no way I can't. The one thing she has been exposed to, though, is a recording of the first ever gig I played years ago as a 17-year-old at a Battle of the Bands at Solihull Sixth Form College.
Okay, and what was the response to that? I do love your gigs, but your first gig was shit.
She asks me to... I've got to tell you the story, and it's slightly embarrassing, and this is... For me, this is like a catharsis, Miles, because the first band I was in, we were called Superman Wallpaper.
Yes.
We were very heavily influenced by the Wonder Stuff.
My apologies.
We were kind of almost like a Wonder Stuff covers band, really.
So hang on, this is just a sideway, another swipe at me.
No. This is the thing.
Because you were doing our songs.
Yeah, no. The thing is, this is the thing. We did a four-song set. We did two Wonder Stuff songs. We did a Bob Dylan song, and we did one song I'd written. And I was so enamoured of the whole Stourbridge scene as presented by the music press at the time, even though I didn't have even the slightest trace of a Birmingham accent at the time, I cultivated this full kind of black country accent for this gig. It is.
You're definitely the only guy that's ever falsified a Birmingham accent or Midlands accent for any other reason than comedy.
You are not the only person. My best mate at uni was from Stourbridge, and I was bored during the summer when we went back home, and I did a rap in the Stourbridge accent. I'll tell you the words. It was, I won't do the accent because it's just a, will I? Okay, then. Let me tell you about my friend, his name is Eric. He pays his dues, he don't pay no tariff. He likes to house and he likes to funk, and he likes to eat and drink lots of junk. Like Toppy Chris from the petrol station, but he's the coolest motherfucker of his generation because he don't drink booze and he don't smoke weed, and the only drug he's linked to is LSD. Stourbridge is a town that he was born in, and he likes to walk home from joy at 5 in the morning. He's a cool-looking dude, a tough act to follow. You give him a fiver, you give it back to you tomorrow. He's kind of cool, and he's kind of baddish, even though he speaks like Baddy the Radish. So I'd like to say hello and salutations to the coolest motherfucker of his generation. Hit it! I don't know why I remembered that, but I did try to do it in a Stourbridge accent, and I'd forgotten that there was a whole Stourbridge connection here, so I'm very pleased.
If you'd be kind enough to write that down for me, it'll be the first track on our next album.
Oh, could you? Oh, magic. That's sorted. Thing is, Alex, what you didn't do was, I mean, you called your band Superman Wallpaper, which is astounding. I had action in my wallpaper myself, but if you were a true Wonder Stuff tribute band, you'd have given yourself an Aldi's version. Name of the Wonder Stuff, like, I don't know, Wonderful Gubbins or something.
The exciting thing.
The exciting ephemera. So I'm gonna form a band called Exciting Ephemera, and that'll be our first track.
Yeah. So we did this gig. So I've got to tell you about this gig because there's a recording of it. It is on archive.org if anybody wants to hear it. I've not split it up into separate tracks. It's just there as it is. She makes me do the accent occasionally after she heard it. Because I used it late years later. I've ended up doing kind of quite kind of extreme electronic stuff over the years. I've kind of left my guitars behind. And
are you the Aphex Triplet?
Yeah, that's me. Yeah, I do this Cornish accent now when I'm playing. It's quite embarrassing, really. I go on stage. I did this. I made this record and I sampled stuff from that gig. And I thought, this is the way I've got to kind of close this circle of shame. So I sampled, there's a couple of tracks on it, which is called My First Gig Without the Music, which has just got all the bits of talking between, which are just painful. And then there's another one called My First Gig Without the Context, which is all the bits without the talking and without the music. So it's all the ums and ahs and bits of feedback. And it just finishes with me going, bye. But she makes me say the song title Unbearable in the accent I did, because we opened with Unbearable, and we fanned it about for a good 5 minutes on stage trying to get the sound to come out of amps and stuff, because you know how it is with these kind of Battle of the Bands type things. The guys who'd organised it put the backline behind the drums and all this kind of stuff, you know, and no monitors apart from one that was maybe facing the audience. So there's this recording of like a good 5 minutes of us just farting about and make little feedback noises. Then we start. I mean, you know, I could start with this ridiculous kind of fake accent, and then I'm like, and our first song is called Unbearable. And we start, and I hit the first.
The crowd went mild.
Yeah, the crowd went mild. Yeah, I hit the first note. I hit it so hard that the E string goes completely out of tune. So for the rest of the song, my guitar's going. Oh, man. So I felt that bringing this up while speaking to the writer of the song was the thing to do, to finally close that shame circle for good.
Yeah, but no, but the thing is, you just added another circle of shame because you just admitted to sampling yourself, which, not worse than that, you didn't even sample yourself, you sampled a young version of yourself. It's even worse than masturbating to a mirror.
I suppose it is.
It's masturbating to a picture of yourself as a 13-year-old, which just takes... It's almost like the worlds of paedophilia and narcissism meeting at a really horrible point.
Oh, God, it's become a sphere of shame.
It's a sphere. That's what it is. You've broken all kinds of dimensions with that kind of shame.
It travels forward in time and it's now going to go on forever via this podcast.
Yeah, I tell you what, Lyle, it's luckily Mal Sun didn't hear about it.
Yeah, thank God I wasn't telling Miles Hunt about that.
He's the last person you want to be in on that.
Yeah, he doesn't need to know any of
I'll
that.
I'll take it to my grave, don't worry. And there's no chance that I'll ever meet Miles. He's in Trotter, apparently, so I don't. It's not a part of the world that I ever visit. So
I've heard he lives near Carol Decker.
Right, can I tell a Carol Decker story then?
Yeah, I
have a Carol Decker story. I'm a bit mad for the Twitter. Alex, do you follow me on Twitter?
I do follow you on Twitter, yes.
I'm a bit pun daft. Now, the thing is, it's not about the pun, it's about the journey to the pun. And this is a good example of this. I did the pun, it was Carol Decker has done a duet with Pauline Black. Apparently, it's quite industrial sounding. So it's clear what the joke is, right? Black and Decker, right? So a few people kind of like groaned, a few people quite liked it. And then Carol Decker tweets me with a, what? And I sort of checked the timeline. It was definitely her. She was having conversations with Tori Wilcox. It was definitely her. And I said, no, sorry, no offense. It's just a crap joke, really, you know, Black and Decker. She said, no, I get the joke. It's just that I did the duet with Pauline Black earlier this year. And it was sort of a tribute to, I think, Pauline's deceased mum or something. So it was a slightly sort of serious point. And then I thought, bloody hell. I wish I'd said to her, did you not have the presence of mind to call yourself Black and Decker? Or was that part of the whole thing was, we're going to get together and deliberately not call ourselves Black and Decker? Or did you just not see the pun value? I never had that conversation with her. But then I gave her all my other two-power jokes and she hated them. I did one about, I did this tweet about you opening an Atlas shop called China in Your Hands. And she got back with, I thought you were a comedy writer.
Well, on the other line right now, we've got Carol Decker. Can you imagine? Oh, man.
She's done a joke with Pauline Black. That's not even a joke anymore.
You just told the truth.
I tell the truth. I tell it like I don't see it.
So I need to ask you, essentially, Fags, Mags and Bags.
Yes.
It's come to an end.
It's come to an end.
And it seemed to come to an end quite suddenly.
Well, it's a strange one. Radio 4 said they didn't want any more of them, which I found slightly baffling because we're actually up for a Writers Guild Award for the third time in a couple of weeks. It's got, you know, thanks to the joys of social networking, we know that there's a fan base out there. There's people that get the joke, the people that are, you know, get the language, get the characters. We seem to be critically acclaimed and popular, apparently, because Radio 4 have got a couple of comedy slots. What they'll do is they'll showcase something, or not showcase it, they'll break in the sort of 11:30 a.m. slot, and then they'll kind of punt it in the 6:30 slot. Now, that's the slot that precedes the Archers. So you tend to get a lot of disgruntled Archers listeners. Right. But we get it both ways, because you get a lot of people saying, why was I subjected to this rubbish before the Archers? And then you get a lot of Fags, Mags and Bags fags saying, why is I subjected to the Archers after listening to Fags? It cuts both ways, but as exposed as that slot was, we still got really, really good feedback. So I don't quite know why they finished it when they did, but we did get 5 series out of it. So, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good 30 episodes, isn't it? So,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
And you see, the thing is, you're saying that, you know, you've got the Archers fans and the Fags, Mags and Bags fans, then you've got somebody like my parents who are both. And they would listen to both. I mean, my mum would ring and say, oh, have you heard the latest episode of Fags, Mags and Bags?
Oh, really? Oh, yeah. That's really sweet. Oh.
Yeah. I think part of it is because I was born in Glasgow.
Yeah,
and my parents lived in Kirkintilloch at the time. So
Kirkintilloch, which isn't far from Lindsay, where
exactly.
We
sit. Exactly. So the whole kind of sphere of reference for Fags, Mags and Bags is something that has always been vaguely familiar. And then recently, I lived in Dundee about 10 years ago. So again, that kind of... You know, the whole kind of Scottish corner shop thing had some resonance. And my mum really loved living in Scotland, so there was a kind of thing for her. So I think she liked the whole thing with the Lensedans and
yes,
the whole malarkey. Miles, if you've not heard it, you've got to.
Okay, I shall look it up. I won't, of course, because where we live next to a great big hill, so we don't get like live radio transmissions very successfully here, and the internet, well, you know, does what it does around here as well. It depends how many squirrels are running across the overhead lines and how good our stream is. So I don't have a TV. I haven't had a TV for 10 years. I don't spend a lot of time listening to other people's work. I tend to sit here and enjoy my own.
Like a little hermit sat in a room listening to nothing but the Wonder Stuff 24 hours a day.
Can I ask, Miles, why don't you have a telly? Did you hate it so much, or yeah, did you feel you could do without it?
It started. I was living in London until 2004, and I was renting a room at a friend's place, and she had Sky and all of that, and it started with me just constantly shouting at adverts, and then the 24-hour news channels, I got sort of hooked on them, and then I just found myself shouting at them, and I thought, okay, when I go back to Shropshire, I'm not having a TV because I might live a few more years than are currently earmarked for me. Just lose the stress of shouting at the telly. I don't miss it a bit. I get sort of mesmerised by it when we're on the road and we're in hotels, and I find myself looking at the TV. Most of all, I just can't believe how fucking, you know, what a decline Western civilisation is truly in. You know, having not seen TV, sort of the development of the decline.
I think the problem is, obviously, like, we're of a certain age where we remember four channels, even three channels.
Yeah.
Now we've got thousands of channels. So a torch is shone into every dark crevice and niche.
Yeah.
And we've seen all the shit. You know, because, you know, let's be honest, I mean, I've been watching a lot of the American stuff and the good British stuff. You know, Alan Partridge has come back. And saying that, though, he did that online first, and that was just gorgeous. Vic and Bob are still making stuff. Obviously, Miles, you've got a connection with those guys.
Yeah.
They're still making stuff. But Bob's playing the dad in a sitcom that starts in a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
It's a thing called, I think, Slackers. It's the females from the boys, the in-betweeners, the females from that film. I've got their own sort of spin-off, and Bob plays the dad of one of them. So he's in a lot of trailers. And so I mean, there's loads of American, the Veep from, you know, the guys who make The Thick of It, which is comedy perfection. I mean, do you get box sets? I mean, do you sort of pick
and choose? I do. Yeah, kind of hooked on that sort of thing. Yeah.
Oh, so what's, because this is it. We've turned into box set Britain. Everyone's had that Breaking Bad conversation.
Yeah.
Everyone's had that Game of Thrones conversation. So where are you? Let's have it now. Where are you at in your box set, Miles?
Well, Breaking Bad, I've got them all apart from the one that hasn't been released yet. But I actually joined Netflix just to be able to see the last series, which I thought was wonderful. I haven't taken to Game of Thrones. I'm visiting things from my youth, really. All of the Happy Days box sets have been watched this year. I'm currently on season 7 of MASH. I'm disappointed to find last night that Radar leaves.
Yeah, he goes. Yeah.
Which I don't remember that as a kid. I don't remember it being Radarless.
I think he comes back, though. I think Radar returns.
Does he?
Yeah, I think he does.
Okay. I'm struggling to. I'm back on Star Trek Next Generation as well at the moment, before tea time, after I finish writing.
You know that Patrick Stewart, he's opened a haberdashery repair shop called Make It So. That's the sort of stuff you're missing out on, Miles, if you don't follow me on Twitter.
Yes, we are. We're into the box sets thing. Made a few errors as well, you know, as you're sort of scanning through. If you've got like an old X-Files one and from Amazon, and then it will say, oh, try Warehouse 13 or whatever. All right, let's order that. And so we've made a few errors like that.
Yeah.
But, box set is pretty much where we're at.
Oh, you're not completely missing out then.
Well, I mean, the end of Breaking Bad, though, I mean, obviously, I don't want to spoil it for people who haven't seen it, but that thing with the UFOs, I just,
it was amazing, wasn't it?
I just wasn't expecting that at all. I did
really,
not see that
really
coming.
Really unexpected, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't see it coming. And the way they tied it into Malcolm in the Middle, I just...
Yeah, oh, God, that was a beautiful squaring of the circle, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And that final bit with Eiffel 65 and Blue,
Even the beautiful simplicity of Jesse being Walt's son. Just beautiful.
Who'd have thought that?
Just, I have my suspicions, I'll be honest. Because do you remember in they sort of sowed the seeds of it in series two, where there was that DNA test, but then they didn't refer to it again. You thought maybe that was just extraneous material, but then it, just the way they come, the callback is just perfect.
And the whole thing with Jesse, Walt Jr. turning out to be a robot.
Yeah, and Skyler being an enormous Chinese man.
Yeah, it's incredible. But no spoilers for those who've not seen it. But yeah, the UFO thing. The,
oh, yeah.
And the explosion. Who could forget the explosion? That final episode, the biggest explosion I've ever seen on television. When the whole, it was like that explosion at the end of Buffy, but bigger.
It was almost as big as the, for me, in terms of, you know, talk about Aunt Masha, the lovely ending. But I think in terms of explosive endings, you can't really beat Rent-A-Ghost.
I don't even remember how Rent-A-Ghost ended. Didn't it just kind of fizzle out?
I must admit, I bailed by the time that the Pantomime Horse rocked up. I'm slightly obsessed with Rent-A-Ghost, and knowing now that Ben Stiller has bought the rights, that sounds like a joke. But if you go on IMDb, look up Rent-A-Ghost, you'll see that Ben Stiller is credited as producer of an unmade film. I just think that obviously Russell Brand will play Timothy Claypool. I can't see that not happening. And they could cast the rest of it any way you want, but I would actually quite like to see Brand as Claypool.
It would be, but would he then kind of demand a revolution and then be vague as to how it was going to be carried out?
Yeah, revolutionise the spiritual. In fact, what would you call Rent-A-Ghost? Was it? They were just a company, weren't they? You did actually rent the ghost, didn't you?
Yes, you rented the ghost.
You rented the ghost. You leased the ghouls.
They were like the reverse Ghostbusters.
They were, weren't they?
Yeah.
It's a beautiful concept. You can see why Ben Stiller bought it into it, actually.
Yeah. I wonder if they could set it up with Ghostbusters. Would it just neutralise both franchises?
Oh, no. That would just be like Jason versus Freddy, wouldn't it? They would neutralise each other. It wouldn't be better. How could it possibly?
It would just make it worse, wouldn't it? So I have to ask, going back again to Fags, Mags and Bags, is there going to be a TV version at any point, or is that it for FMB?
Well, no, we're looking into it. What we did was... I must admit, we try to be objective about it, but I think it's really good. And also, you know, they're talking now about Open All Hours, which was the only ShopCom, which I'm going to use that expression now. Take it, run with it, tell your friends, ShopCom. It's the only one that ever was. It was the only time a sitcom was entirely set in a convenience store, a shop. And they're talking now about them bringing it back as a one-off this Christmas with David Jason, the Granville owning the shop. And I think, oh, for bloody hell, I wanted us to be the next ShopCom. Because I just think that everyone goes into these shops, everyone knows the setup. I mean, Miles, you haven't heard the show, but if I say to you, Wall of Crisps, I'm hoping now that you've visualized it, in every shop of that nature, you get a 4x4 or a 5x5 Wall of Crisps. And the wafers and the what's-its and the outer spaces and the... Your posher crinkle cut crisps maybe hovering to the top left corner, but your more kiddie oriented crisp towards the bottom. And then you can talk about the chocolate stanchion, which is that kind of standardized stadium of chocolates where the Twix are next to the Topics or next to the Starburst, or, you know, your Turkish Delight hover slightly above because they're just a bit, with the Ruffle bars and the Ritter Sport, they hover a bit higher. Then, you know, if we talk about a card to sell, that's the spinning rack of cards, which are generally 99 pence. And there'll maybe be one graduation card or one christening card, but most of them are, frankly, sympathy cards. And they are that slightly embossed nature. They, you know, but it's the point is, we all know the setup. We all feel at home there. And the thing is that it doesn't matter who you are. You have to go into these shops. I mean, online shopping has kicked off in a big way. But if you want to buy a Toffee Crisp, you're not going to buy it online. You're going to go in a corner shop. And if you're Prince Philip, you're not good. Well, yeah, Prince Philip, maybe not. But we all go into these shops. So I think that the set of the com is very, very familiar to people, and I think they feel very much at home in that scenario. So I think a sitcom set in that scenario is, frankly, a stick-on. It's a surefire winner. We, I think, have managed to also play out the surrealness, the surreality of the corner shop. Because if you think about, especially with crisps and sweets, you know, the very idea of a tiny fried egg, you know, smaller than the palm of your hand, or a tiny a chocolate tool. Who decides to miniaturize hardware and make it a chocolate? I find that baffling and quite beautiful, but people just seem to accept this. And your crisps, you know, I mean, if you go on, I don't know, Alex, if you've been on onto our sort of Facebook page, yeah, and we did some virally stuff, and we actually did the wall of crisps, and it hits things like cheese and chives, small particle colliders. The idea, you know, and that if that was a real thing, people probably wouldn't bat an eyelid. He said, "Yeah, of course, someone's miniaturized the Hadron Collider and given it cheese and chive dust. Why wouldn't they?" Whereas I'm like, is no one else seeing how bizarre this is? Why am I buying tiny candy bananas when the real thing is next door? So hopefully we managed to play the sort of the everyday quotidian sort of almost dull stuff of everyday life with the surrealness that comes with all these products. And also just as a massive fan of Cheers growing up, and I kind of see it like a dry Cheers where everyone does know your name because, well, frankly, I, as Ramesh, I know what magazines you get. I know what you're into. I also know if you're buying a packet of rich tea and chocolate digestives and a word search, I know what you're doing that afternoon. If you buy Lucozade, which is non-isotonic, and a bumper a puzzler, I know you're going to the hospital for a visit. So I'm like the Matrix. I know everything that's going on in the neighborhood. And I'm, I guess, like Sam and Cheers, but I want to put everyone together. I'm not a divisive person. I'm an inclusive person. So I just think, actually, I would love to see it on the telly because of the visual aspect. You don't get that on the radio, and you can't say that for every radio sitcom. Sometimes it doesn't help to visualize it, but I think in this scenario it does, because people will feel at home even more seeing all these things.
Yeah, I mean, we have a shop exactly like that just across the road from where I live. But one thing I would say, if it does go to the TV, is there any way we can avoid a laugh track?
Oh, we were very prescriptive about it. I find a lot of, I don't know about you, I find a lot of Radio 4 comedy insufferably smug. Mm-hmm. And it's because they're waiting for the laugh. I'd rather batter on and say, well, if you don't get this very niche observation about Chris Akabuzi, this is 1 in 2 minutes about Bishop Desmond Tutu. They're not all black, by the way. But I love packing it full of tiny little jokes and tiny stupid little almost fag-end jokes, but battering through it, not waiting for the laugh. But, you know, it's up to you. You've got to listen. A lot of people listen to Radio 4 like wallpaper, but I'd like to think with Bags, Magazine, Bags, you kind of have to tune in and kind of have to concentrate, because you do try to pack it full of stuff. And coming back to your point about the telly, the production team, we've noticed that a lot of things that are really popular just now do have an audience. Things like Mrs. Brown's Boys and Citizen Khan, which I have my own problems with, but I won't go into that. So we thought, well, is it worth us doing it on stage as a kind of live Goons-esque script reading with an audience, just to film it, do maybe 5-minute cut of it, send it to commissioners? So we put a night on in Glasgow where we just got the cast together, about 8 of us. And like I say, we didn't even learn the scripts. We showed up with the scripts, read it off script, didn't do any costumes. People came from Brighton for this. Mm-hmm. People came from Hexham, Newcastle, for this script reading. And we talk about the community of Bags and Bags and Bags. It felt like that night. So we filmed it, but Donnie, who writes it with me, and he's Dave in it, we both thought, maybe we don't need to do this on the telly. Maybe we just do it as a live show. So we might actually do that. We might tour it, or we might take it to Edinburgh or something. And then that will add grist to the telly mill, if you will. But I can see it as a live show.
Yeah, I'd be there, definitely. I mean, I would have come up if I hadn't had work, you know.
You're more than welcome
to see it. Miles, you have to hear this show. It is a fantastic thing.
I don't think Miles would like it.
I don't think
Miles is a known racist. That's why he left Starbridge. Am I wrong, Miles?
Yeah.
I like the way he's just like, yeah, you're wrong.
Just talking about the laugh track thing, though, there, on the MASH DVD, you can have it with the laugh track, which they had in America, or an option without the laugh track, which is, of course, how I watch it, because that's how it was given to us on BBC Two. And it's really odd. If you watch it with the laugh track, it's not funny. If you watch it without the laugh track, it's funny.
It's interesting you mentioned that, because I remember the night that BBC Two accidentally played it with the laugh track.
Okay.
And it happened just once, and Points of View was flooded with letters the following week.
Really?
But I remember sitting down with my family to watch it, and it had the laugh track, and all of us having this kind of look of horror on our faces, like, what's this? Why? What's going on?
Yeah, it's awful.
It just... Hey. terrible because the laughs are just so, and it makes all the jokes just horrible. And it's weird because it changes it from being this kind of quite bleak, quite touching commentary about war that's kind of quite true to being this awful third-rate sitcom.
Yeah, it's amazing. And keeping the keeping some themes going with the camping of MASH and of the corner shop idea. The nearest shop to where I live, it being very rural around here, is a campsite shop. So if you're in the market for clothes pegs, tent pegs and bottles of gas, it's fantastic. Anything beyond that, cleaning products, etc. Oh, very tiny and lightweight and cheap saucepans it's good for as well. Yeah, but that's another nice spin on the local shop.
It's the I've always liked kind of campsite shops. There's always been something kind of oddly...
Well, if you're in one, it usually means you're on holiday, so then that's a cherished memory.
I think you're absolutely right. I don't think you'd be...
I've just thought of the next thing I'm going to write. It's going to be called Pegs, Eggs and Legs.
Nice.
Yeah, that's what I'm going to do. I'm getting on with that straight away. But the laughter track thing, it's weird. I'll ask you now, are you both fans of I'm Alan Partridge?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's got a laughter track. But the thing is, it's not a laughter track. They actually filmed it with an audience.
Apparently
what they did was they built the fourth wall in. So what they did was they filmed it with an audience present, but the audience were watching on monitors.
Really?
Because Armando Iannucci was worried that the performers would big their performances up if they saw the whites of the eyes of the audience.
Okay.
But I happily would have watched Alan Partridge without laughter at all. I don't think it denigrates from it. I don't think it makes the comedy any less intelligent. I know from my perspective as a comedy writer, if I know there's going to be an audience there, I probably will dumb the jokes down or make them more physical or more obvious. And that's something that we never wanted to do with our sitcom. So I think it definitely changes the nature of what you write, if you know. But I think Alan Partridge is maybe the one that somehow plays both ends against the middle. But having said that, I'd be happy for it to have no audience laughter whatsoever.
Yeah. Well, talking of writing, Miles, you're writing a book.
Yeah. I've threatened to do so for many years, but I had the perfect excuse. My favourite writer when I was in my early 20s was Charles Bukowski, and at some point in his many books he said that nobody under the age of 40 has any right to become an author because they have nothing of interest to say before you're 40. So I thought, right, I'm taking that as advice. I don't have to start until I'm 40. Well, that was 7 years ago, so I've been sort of dragging my boots a little bit. And I didn't want to write a standard rock biography because I don't like them. I don't like reading them. They all follow a very similar format. Really not interested in what your grandparents did and... which is usually the first 40 or 50 pages. And, you know, the last 100 pages are usually the decline of whoever's career it is, so you don't want to read that either. So it was my own fault. I spent 2 years reading solely rock biographies to get a handle on it, but I sort of spoiled the experience by reading too many of them. Anyway, so I sat down and started, and to my horror, 50 pages in, I had followed exactly the movement that I had not intended to. Thankfully, I showed it to a mate, and he said, I thought you weren't doing this. And I'm like, oh, fuck. So he gave me, and he'd studied literature at Cambridge, and he gave me some great, tips, and it was pretty brutal. And although I haven't scrapped everything that I wrote, I started again. Well, I was lucky enough when the band started in 86, I didn't keep a diary in 86, but in 87 I started to keep a diary, and I've continued to do that ever since. So I've got all these handwritten diaries that I'm transcribing and then adding anecdotes and reminiscences to those. So it's the book started. It's just called The Wonderstuff Diaries Part 1, and I'm just going to write 86 to 94 when we originally broke up and just cover those years. I'm amazed at my capacity to remember, I am remembering, of course, anecdotes that have been told over and over and over again, you know, since whatever was the original instance. So it probably will turn out that none of them are true. They've just been embellished over the years by, you know, telling them to each other. But it's great. I'm very happy that I've finally sat down and done something different other than looking for tunes and lyrics. Yeah, I'm enjoying it. I hope I'll get it finished by February, then give it to an editor to take a axe to, and then look to publishing it in October 2014.
Sounds good. I mean, it does remind me of something I was going to ask you about. I remember reading this, and I tried to Google it and couldn't find it anywhere. Is it true that the bass thing scratched across the track of The Animals and Me on his copy of The Eight Leg Groove Machine?
Yes, it's absolutely true, yeah.
Ah, there you go. I can't remember where I read that, but...
Well, it was brought on by... because we were fans of, you know, all the contemporary bands that were happening at the same time, particularly Potwillie itself, and they'd, you know, Graham Crabb was originally their drummer, and then he switched to be the second vocalist, and was also pretty much in charge of leading them into the using technology over just the raw guitar-based drum sounds that they previously had. And... we were sitting around the studio one day mucking around with this song, The Animals and Me, that we'd been on the periphery of our set for a while. And Jilksy was the one that suggested it, oddly, being our drummer. So let's do this with drum machines and, you know, give it a more contemporary feel. So he started doing that. Bob Jones, the bass thing, hated it. He just said, I'm not playing to a fucking drum machine. Stormed out of the studio. I ended up playing bass on that track. And then, as you just rightly said, when the pressings of the records came in on vinyl, Bob just took a pin off his motorbike jacket and scratched the track off so we never had to listen to it.
Lads, can I interrupt?
Of course. Yep.
I've got to go pick my boy up from school. This is
okay.
Tragic. Miles, I really want to read your book. I'm going to... I've always liked your work. I've always thought you were really funny. I'm really looking forward to seeing you off the leash, not having to phrase or rhyme stuff, and just, you okay. know, like letting your mind run wild, because I'm a big fan over the years. So I'm really sorry I've got to very rudely leave you, but my wee boy will be on.
I shall get in touch with you on Twitter as soon as we've wrapped this up, and I'll keep you abreast of things.
Good man. And say hello to Carol for me as well. and Alex, a pleasure to chat to you. Sorry I've got to disappear.
That's
like this.
Fine, Sanjeev. Thank you
stay
very,
in touch,
very much.
Guys. And thanks very much.
Lovely speaking. Bye.
Cheers, man. Thanks. Thanks, Alex.
Thank Ta-da. You. So yes, I mean the book. As Sanjeev says, I'm very much looking forward to reading this. And I know you were saying that in some cases people aren't interested in rock biographies.
Yeah.
Were there any particular ones you read that you thought were great, and others that you thought were absolute shit-tastic?
I think my favourite one was by Joyce Raskin, and Joyce was the bass player in a band called Scarce.
Yeah, was it called Breaking Through or something, the book?
It's called Aching to Be.
That's the one, yeah.
And it's absolutely beautiful. And I suppose the beauty of it is that Scarce didn't reach their full commercial potential because their vocalist and, you know, principal songwriter, Chick, had a brain aneurysm. Mm. Right as they were about to, you know, go, they toured Europe. They were a stunning three-piece band, perfect for the time, great songs. And it was Chick had fronted another band prior to Scarce, so it was lovely to see him, you know, getting recognition across the world. And then suddenly he had this brain aneurysm, and that just knocked him out of commission for years. So what Joyce writes about is, you know, this... this rise, it's about to go off, fantastic, we're travelling out to Europe, because they're from Boston. Mm-hmm. And then Chick's illness just scuppers the whole thing. And then it gets worse than that, when, as Chick recuperated, his partner didn't want him to go back into the world of music. So there was no attempt to catch up after a couple of years of recuperation. And so what you get is a really honest account of this argument that basically goes on in Joyce's head of, like, I love my friend Chick, but I hate my friend Chick because I was about to become a rock goddess.
Yeah.
and it's really honest, really, really beautiful. It's fantastic. She became a painter and has enjoyed life doing that. And then in more recent years, Scarce have indeed got back together and done shows again, but not with an eye on the prize, just to do it because, you know, they enjoy doing it. So there's a sort of a happy, well, there is a happy ending, and of course Chick lived. The aneurysm didn't kill him.
So I remember, wasn't it several days or hours until they found him? Because wasn't he due to turn up at rehearsals or something? And
I think it was at least a day and a half. Yeah.
And he was in a really bad state, from what I remember.
Yeah, really bad.
Because he was in, I think, was it Anastasia Screamed he was
That's
in before?
It's Anastasia Screamed, yes. Yeah.
And right. I think at one point he was engaged to Tanya Donnelly, so...
Okay, well, I knew Joyce because she had a relationship with Dave Gibbs, the singer of Gigolo Aunts.
Yeah.
Who, of course, is one of the creators of Rock of Ages, the stage show and film. Which amuses me no end, and I'm sure amuses him even more. I think that was one of my favourites. Chris Connolly from Ministry, how he's got past the lawyers, or I don't know, because you know, him talking about his relationship with Al Jourgensen over the years in Ministry is pretty amazing. That's a great one. And I shan't slag anybody's by name.
So the two that I really liked, I really liked the Julian Cope ones, Head On and Repossessed.
Yeah, I read those years ago when they came out. They're great, and Krautrock Sampler's great. Yeah.
The way he writes is just so kind of, there's no pretense at trying to big himself up as some kind of rock god. He's very much like, I'm just this bloke, and these are all the mistakes I made over 30 years or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, and also he does an amazing thing with Krautrock Sampler, which is his love of the Krautrock scene, German music, the late 60s and the early 70s. And I had a couple of records. I had Can records, I had some Kraftwerk records, but I didn't have things like Ashrar Temple or Neu. But the way he wrote about them, and I was living in London at the time, and Tower Records on Piccadilly was open till midnight, and I'd be lying on a settee in my flat in London, you know, at like 10:30 at night, reading this description of a Neu record, and of course this is way before the internet, and me just going, I have to fucking hear that record right now, and, you know, getting on the tube, going into town, and getting, and that happened twice, and I think that illustrates what a powerful writer Julian is. Yeah, he's brilliant. All of his books are brilliant.
Yeah, well, and his book about standing stones and stone circles, I believe, has become part of expected reading on people doing university courses about this.
I think I've heard that too, yeah.
It's become the one to, you know, the go-to book about, well, European standing stones, because he did the Modern Antiquarian and then the European Antiquarian or something like that. A very, very smart guy. The other one I really liked, 45 by Bill Drummond.
Yes, great. Got that. Looking at it now, it's on the shelf.
Very similar vibe in the same way of writing, but obviously they come from a kind of similar background, the two of them. But yeah, that kind of, again, this is the mistakes I made, and describing himself going to the library to write the book, and, you know, it partly inspired me to go and write all my things down, and, you know, I was unemployed, I needed something to do, so I would go every day down to Solihull Library and sit for a couple of hours and write.
Yeah.
And it was purely because I'd read that's how he wrote his. He'd sit there in the same place every day, then go and have his little routine of having a cup of coffee, and, you know, that seems to be the way to do it.
Is that the book where he mentions that him and the roadie Gimpo drive around the M25 25 times?
Yes, and they go a bit mental. They think it's this fantastic idea, and it just turns to this hellish nightmare. But they can't stop doing it. They have to finish.
That's right, yeah. They're committed to it. Yeah, they're insane by the end of it.
It's the one with the cube of beer. The cube of beer cans that turns into just a truck full of beer cans, because they have this idea that it's going to be this perfect cube of beer cans that on the New Year's Eve they'll go around and give it out to all the homeless, and then it doesn't hold together, and it all just,
imagine that.
Yeah, who'd have thought? And it, you know, it all could have just, when they go around corners, it all starts to shake and kind of slew everywhere, and it ends up just being the back of the truck full of beer cans. But they were always ones for the big kind of dramatic endeavours that never seemed to quite work. You know, like the burning of £1 million that they then decided afterwards that had maybe not been such a brilliant idea, and then tried to shop the remains around to art galleries to see how much they could get back. And I saw a really fantastic, I think it was Imagine on BBC Two once, and Jimmy Courtney just sitting in his kitchen going, yeah, most of the time I'm fine about it. But then other days I think, shit, we burned £1 million.
No, they were great, sort of audacious stunts, and you know, they have to be applauded for. I mean, brilliant.
Absolutely. So we should probably wrap things up. But so, Miles, what's coming up next with the Wonder Stuff, and of, you know, and other things in the world of Mr. Hunt?
Well, in December we go out on our winter tour with Pop Elite Self and Jesus Jones. We're doing Sheffield, Bristol, Edinburgh, Birmingham and London. And in readiness for those gigs, we've just actually got round to pressing up a limited edition vinyl copy of our current album, Oh No, It's the Wonder Stuff, which is double, because we also did a project called From the Midlands with Love, where we covered 10 Midlands band songs. So that's a double album on vinyl. We're reissuing my first solo album from 1999 called Hairy on the Inside, which comes with 17 track extra CD of demos and songs I didn't use for the Hairy on the Inside album. So they're just songs from around that period. And we've been fortunate enough to have our friend George Taylor, who's amongst many other favours he does for us, has made all our recent video promos for the recent singles. He has made a DVD rockumentary about the band, which we've been filming for the last 18 months, but we put that to bed on Tuesday. That's now with the manufacturer. So we've got those fun three little releases coming out in December. And then we were going to just take some time off. I was going to finish writing the book and then start writing some songs for the next Wonder Stuff album. But we had the offer of gigging in Hong Kong, Dubai and Australia, which you can't look that one in the face and say no. So we're going out at the end of February to do those three areas of the world. And then we were thinking, OK, take the summer off to do writing. But V Festival have kindly made an offer that they want us to do two of the V festivals in the summer. I don't know whether that's confirmed yet, but it's certainly something we want to say yes to. And I suppose if we're doing two festival shows, then we'll do some of the shows as we've bothered to rehearse again. And looking to do something along the same lines of the Pop Will Eat Itself, Wonder Stuff and Jesus Jones bill for next December, but with different bands. Under the Slater UK moniker that we've been using. And hopefully by October next year, my book will be available for people to put on their shelves and occasionally thumb through. And then that's about it, really.
Fantastic. Well, yeah, I will get Superman wallpaper back together.
Come on the bill with us next December.
We'll come and support you. And, you know, I better warn you, we know your songs pretty well. I could do a mean Starbridge accent. It's fantastic. There was something I was going to ask you before we finish, and I can't remember what it was. It was literally, you know, those things where you sometimes have something in your head. That was it.
Right.
I've seen a couple of the stills that you've posted from the video. And the first thing I was going to say, I'd been wondering about Welcome to the Cheap Seats and if that was ever going to be reissued. And the other thing about Welcome to the Cheap Seats is my brother makes a very brief appearance in that.
Really?
In the audience, just flying past the camera.
Great.
He kind of freeze frames it, goes, "That's me." And it's like his face. But yeah, so firstly, yeah, Welcome to the Cheap Seats. Any chance of a reissue of that anytime?
Do you know, we have absolutely no relationship with Universal. It used to be Polygram that own it. I think the last thing that they did was some awful cobbled together BBC sessions, of which we only ever did two, and the BBC had lost one of them. And I, you know, I just said, firstly, I said, "Well, can I write the sleeve notes?" And obviously I would do that for free because it's in my interest to get the story right. And I was bypassed for that. And it went to Martin Roach, who'd written the eight-legged atomic dustbin will eat itself. And the actual collection of tracks was crap. And misleading, you know, it was called something like the Wonder Stuff at the BBC, and I was just very annoyed at them to be sort of, you know, like, you can have as much help from me as you need to make this a decent package. And they just sort of rode roughshod over me. So we don't really have a relationship with Universal. It would be nice to see Cheap Seats reissued again. And I think it was probably 10 years ago. There is a DVD version of it that I know last time I looked a couple of years ago, you can still get it on Amazon, and it's coupled with the 11 appalling promos thing as well. So that's out there. It's not, you know,
it's not lost to time.
Not totally, but you know, the big labels. I was reading something earlier today that, you know, it's the labels that have destroyed the record industry, and just not using what they've got out there and reissuing the same old Beatles, you know, records. It's just dreary beyond belief when you just think of the stuff that's there. Not wishing to blow our own trumpet on this. Not wonder stuff's reissues are going to save the record industry at this point. But,
you know. Mike, you just said something a second ago which also reminded me of another teenage argument. I used to insist that it was called the eight-legged groove machine, and other friends insisted it was called the eight-legged groove machine. Which would you say was the correct one?
Well, I know what the correct one is. My title is Legged.
Legged? In your face, teenage friends. In your face.
It's the rhythm of the title.
Yes.
Legged groove machine. Yeah. Legged groove machine just sounds flat.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I know because I'm a songwriter.
Yeah, and it was your title, as you say. Vindication after 23 years. Yes, fantastic.
And you're still here and they're not.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm talking to Mars Hunt, people who are now not talking to Mars Hunt. So... in your face again, double in your face. Yeah, the last thing I was going to say was looking at the stills that you posted on Facebook from the video, you don't seem to have aged, Miles.
Yeah, I can't really give a decent account of myself for that, to be honest.
Do you have a painting of Jay Maskus in your loft?
Yes, that's exactly what I've got.
You know, a man who I believe you once dubbed a git.
Did I?
I believe so.
Yeah. I know I was pissed off at him for a period because I did that stint working at MTV presenting their 120 minutes alternative music show, and I was sent out to Barcelona for 3 days to interview Jay, and he wouldn't see me until 4 o'clock in the morning on the last night. I mean, I had a lovely time hanging around in Barcelona for 3 days, but he wouldn't do the interview. And then, you know, I was pretty good at asking questions that could not be answered with a simple yes or no. But somehow he managed to answer every question with simply a yes, no, or it was painful. I hated every second. I was furious at him because I was such a huge fan. Over the years, I've got over it, and I'm still a huge fan of his music, but yeah, it was a difficult interview, but I'm not the first to say that. So
you see, this is the thing I fear with doing the podcast is at some point I fear that somebody who I really respect is going to turn out to be a complete arse, but so far it hasn't happened.
Good.
Fingers crossed, but it's going to happen one day. But then I've been talking to creationists for 3.5 years. I'll be fine. I'll just be able to. I spoke to Steve Drain from Westboro Baptist Church. He hung up on me because he was so offended.
Blimey.
So we got. He's the only person who's ever actually hung up on the other podcast and just gone. but yeah, I felt that was a win that Steve Drain had gone because he's such an awful human being. But, so if anybody ever does, yeah, if I ever get an awkward interview, then. But I like to think that this podcast is more of a kind of a chat, and it's a happy little gathering of people.
Well, it's certainly been enjoyable for me, and again, thank you for the introduction to Sanjay.
Well, his stuff is amazing. I will mention something to you once we finish the podcast, just so that I don't implicate myself in anything illegal, listeners. But Miles Hunt, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you. I hope the book goes well. I will look forward to reading it, and I hope the tour goes well. And yes, I will dust off the Superman wallpaper, shorts and baseball cap, and be ready to rock come 2015.
Lovely. Thanks, Alex.
Thank you, and goodbye.
See you, man.
Future Library is brought to you by petpiranha.com, where you can go and find out various things about people who we've talked about and various people who haven't been on the podcast yet, but might be in the future. If you want to follow us on Twitter, it's twitter.com/futurelibrary1, so that's Future Library with a number 1. And you can email me at alexbottom@gmail.com. And don't forget to subscribe via iTunes. Just search for Future Library there. That's it. Thanks.